the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. We have Bob Lupke today and Brooke Medina. Bob, what's your title? You are the policy director here at Civitas. Is
director
that correct?
Of policy, yes.
Director of policy. My co-host, Brooke Medina. It's going to be an all education podcast. Brooke, Bob, how's it going today?
I am fine. I am sequestered in my office here. Doing fine, plugging along. Brooke, how are you?
I'm doing well. I am not sequestered in my office at Civitas. I'm sequestered in my office / bonus room / room that the kids like to make a big mess of and no one wants to clean it up room.
Thanks for that mental picture.
You're telling me that the males in your house don't clean up, Brooke?
I'm telling you the males and some of the females don't clean up in the house. We've got three males, three females.
Well, in our house, it's three males and a female, so I feel sorry for my wife, especially since she really wanted daughters. Obviously, she loves our kids more than anything, but she really wanted a little girl, and maybe she'll get one, but, you know, it's tough for her.
Maybe she'll get one like she's going shopping on Amazon or
right.
something.
I doubt it, but you never know.
Ray, how does it feel to be a genuine human cross to bear, huh?
Right, yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Well, you guys, I know we were right before we started recording, we were talking about what we were going to open up with. And of course, we're covering education, all things education, but honing in on some stuff that's really relevant and timely here in North Carolina, some of the battles that are happening here. But I thought it'd be good for us to kick off with our favorite or just something memorable from our school years growing up. So, Ray, why don't you go first?
The girls at Ole Miss, woo! Those are a lot of beautiful women down there in Mississippi. No, that actually wasn't the story I was going to tell. But back in Mississippi, in 10th grade, I moved from Egypt to Mississippi. I didn't know a soul. I didn't have any friends. We were living off base, and I didn't have any friends in the school. And Mississippi is a little bit of a closed society. But I had a teacher, Douglas Brimenkamp, who taught history. And I always liked history, but I got even more interested in history because he would tell these great stories. And I just remember doing World War II and him telling stories about Pappy Boyington, who was a fighter ace, and then talking about the great mission to bomb Japan I can't think of his name at the moment, but it happened on April 18th. The first bombing of Japan in 1942, the Doolittle Raiders, that's who it was. And he told the story of the Doolittle Raiders, and he was just so good at storytelling, and he was so good at talking about the conflict, and it just really kind of ingrained in me a passion for history and really studying history and being more meaningful in my reading. And it was always odd to me that the rest of the kids in the class had no interest in history, and I just devoured everything I started to read on U.S. history especially. So he was really a good teacher that helped launch just a lifelong passion of history. So, you know, I've obviously had a lot of good teachers and had some really bad teachers and bad experiences, but he always stands out as one of the greats to me.
That's wonderful. And including your Ole Miss comment, I thought that was pretty funny. But yeah, you know, there's nothing like the power and the impact of a really good teacher that loves their students and their job. So, Bob, what about you?
Well, Ray, I have to kind of second your line of thinking here. I too had a high school history teacher who he was a history teacher, but he also every year he taught a class in the Constitution, and the school would have a Constitution contest, which he was famous for. developing. But he too had the knack for bringing that document alive. You know, he knew it, had an exceptional knowledge of the Constitution, colonial history, etc. And his passion was infectious amongst students. And he did a whole heck of a lot to just cultivate a love of history and a love of the Constitution. And I found out about 6-8 months ago that the guy retired last year. He had been there, I kid you not, over 50 years.
Wow. I bet he had a decent pension.
Well, it was a Catholic high school.
Oh.
I doubt if it was, anything.
No wonder he had to work 50 years, Bob.
I doubt if it was anything exorbitant. But everyone loved the guy. Mr. Cornick was his name. And it's amazing how, when somebody just pops the question like this, who you think of right away? And Ray and I both thought of history teachers, who seemingly had the same effect. He infected us with a love of history, a love of the Constitution, and helped us, develop that, into something that's lifelong and obviously part of our day-to-day living. But I tip my cap to him. A lot of other people did too. He's a great guy. And, he did a lot for me to just kind of cultivate that love.
So I'm not trying to be a copycat, but yeah, one of my teachers who taught me history as well as other things though, because I attended a small private school, and same thing though, this love for and an understanding of the world around me and helping me connect the past to my present and sort of forecast or have a vision for the future. I think that that's something unique that those that teach history can bring to the table. And so one of my school experiences, sixth grade, was in Mrs. Stanger's class. And we got to study Egypt that year. So Ray, you were talking about just coming from Egypt and the teacher that made that impact on you in 10th grade. But I loved studying ancient Egypt. And I was ordinarily, I kind of was a little bit mischievous as a student. And I was kind of precocious too. I mean, I was smart. But I was so busy sometimes getting into mischief that I wasn't paying as close attention to my grades and things like that. And so Mrs. Stanger really helped me kind of rise to the challenge and not goof off all of the time. And she made history just so interesting to me that I was much more willing to engage with it and actually kind of put my nose to the grindstone. And so that made an impact on me. And to this day, I love history, although I don't read nearly the number of historical accounts as Ray does.
I think on the next podcast, I want to tell my Planned Parenthood story, which was not a positive experience. But in seventh grade, Planned Parenthood came into my classroom in Hawaii and taught us about all kinds of stuff that I knew nothing about.
Really?
So I think that would be a really fascinating story. I can't remember if I've told that on the podcast. I think I've maybe referenced it, but I haven't gone too deeply into it. So I've been in a lot of different schools with a lot of different backgrounds and stuff. And so it kind of was the day, Bob, that I became a social conservative maybe when Planned Parenthood came into my class in seventh grade. But anyways, I'm not going to go into that right now because we don't have time. But I do want to discuss this NCAE lawsuit because our polling has consistently shown the popularity of the opportunity scholarships. We've heard from parents at some of the Civitas events that utilize this scholarship, how popular and effective it is for their family. It's a $4,200 grant or $4,200 payment, so someone can shop around those dollars for a private school for their child. So, Bob, give us a little background on this lawsuit and why is it occurring if the plan is so popular?
Well, it's occurring if you want to get cut right to the chase, because it's a program that's growing. When it started, it was only like 1,200 students. Now it's up to 12,100 students. And it's a backdoor exit, out of the public schools for kids that need a better education. It's working. And I think a lot of the powers that be in some of these schools are threatened by it. Because with children, attached to kids usually are dollars. So I think the teachers union feels threatened by it because of the growth, as we've seen here over the last 5 years, the program has grown dramatically. There's a demand for it. It works. It provides kids with an opportunity to attend a better school, a school that fits them. You know, there's been a lot of success. Parents laud it. There's high satisfaction rates. I mean, the research done on it, as far as test scores, show that the first year improvements are significant and positive. So it's had a lot of good press. You kind of expected this when Governor Cooper, you know, took office. We kind of figured this might be coming down the pipe because, I mean, everyone knows he's not a fan of the Opportunity Scholarship Program. He's trying to shut it down a couple of times with his budget, where he essentially zeroed out the program and would let it die with people that are currently in there and not renew it. And he's also, you know, I went to court to also battle, you know, a provision that increases funding on it each year by $10 million just to help with the year-to-year budgeting on it. And he lost that case. So, and we all know that, you know, the teachers unions and their leadership are no fan of vouchers and no fan of letting parents decide where their kids want to go to school. The popularity of this program and the growth of it has put it, you know, in the sights of, you know, the union leaders and the teacher leaders in North Carolina. And there are a lot of people watching this at other places around the country. There's a similar case with a similar, smaller voucher program in Maryland, but legally it's much the same as far as what they're asking to do, et cetera. So it's garnered a lot of interest, and we'll see what happens.
So, Bob, you know, we recently did an online panel for our Facebook audience, and we delved deeper into this Opportunity Scholarship lawsuit. But there's other areas and avenues for families in the state of North Carolina to access school choice. Obviously, we don't have universal choice like some states. I think Arizona is one that has universal choice regardless of like special needs and things like that. But can you just give us a quick overview of some of the other choice options that we have here in the state?
Yeah, I mean, there are, I mean, as far as state-based programs, we've got the largest one is obviously charter schools, which right now there are about 117,000 kids in North Carolina charter schools. There's about 100 and almost 195 or 196 charter schools in North Carolina. That's a significant population. As people know, charter schools are public schools, but they're also different in the sense that they have more freedom to develop around certain curricular areas, have certain they're not subject to the regular regulations and administrative structures of the traditional public schools. And the main difference is that they are governed by a private board rather than a public school board. So that's significant, but they can adapt more readily to changes. They're more close. I think they're, by and large, they're much more responsive to parent concerns and more parent-centric, simply because obviously their revenue is driven obviously in large part by enrollment. So, but charter schools are very popular. We talked about the Opportunity Scholarship Program. Again, that's highly popular. I mean, our last poll in January, I believe when we asked if you favor or oppose the Opportunity Scholarship, we had about, I think it was 67%. Two-thirds of respondents said that they favor it. Looking back historically, those numbers have traditionally been in anywhere from the low 60s, sometimes even into the low 70s for strong popularity for that. And we also have special needs programs. We have a special needs development grant, which provides parents with special needs with a grant up to $8,000 a year, $4,000 a semester to help meet their needs. And they can use that money, you know, on therapies, on tuition for a school that meets their child's needs, and other, you know, other specific special needs oriented education services. And along with that, we also have most recently passed in 2017 an ESA for special needs kids. That was passed, I think I just said 2017, but and that allows parents to be eligible for a grant up to $9,000. But what it does, the novelty of that is it provides them basically an account, a state funded account up to, you know, that up to a $9,000 limit. And they can use that money on educational services, therapies, you know, anything to actually, you know, address the educational needs of their special needs child. That's proven very popular. And we're hoping to add to that in the near future as far as size and so forth. But it's a smaller program, and we kind of kept it a little bit on the small side initially just to see how things would go. But North Carolina was the fifth state that enacted an ESA plan. And, you know, we're hoping, you know, that we can grow that and, you know, just allow other parents and to experience what it's like to have that freedom, but also expand it past the, you know, the special needs population. For some states, Arizona expanded it to foster kids, also to kids in failing schools. And I also think that they also expanded it to dependents of active military personnel. So those are all good things, and I think it would help other people just to see the benefits of education savings accounts, which I think are really the future of school choice. And then those are the state programs. Obviously, there's the option of homeschooling, private schools, virtual schools. So, I mean, in the last 10 years, we've done a lot to expand educational options, but that's what the public wants. If you look at any of the polling that we've done the last 10 years or so, they want choice and they want more choice. They're not satisfied currently with the options that most of their kids have. So we're trying to be responsive to that.
Shifting gears here just a little bit, especially related to the COVID-19 pandemic, we've got the NCAE obviously putting a lot of pressure on school boards. They're trying to block a lot of children from going back to school, in part, I guess, in their mind, to protect teachers and to protect their, you know, the constituency that they represent, which is not students, but teachers. You know, help us see the NCAE a little bit, you know, kind of their political background. I mean, people listening may remember the two big walkouts or strikes that we've had over the last few years in North Carolina and call for more teacher pay. But there's other political, you know, asks that they're making and political requests or demands that they're making in their statements, and you can find on their website. Give us a little bit of a political background of the NCAE and what they're up to, not just right now, but what is kind of their goal for North Carolina? And obviously people want to support teachers, but is this a problematic organization if you're trying to, you know, focus really on education, whether your views on school choice, but trying to focus on education here in the state?
Yeah, actually, if anyone's interested in that question, I just wrote two pieces on that topic, which are accessible on our website.
Wait, but Bob, can you repeat that? Bob, can you repeat that, please? Because you cut out a little bit.
Oh, I just wrote two pieces on our website, which is basically, you know, taking a closer look at the NCAE and how, you know, most people think, you know, they're familiar with teachers' unions and that, and they kind of grumble and think, well, you know, many of them are money grubbers, et cetera. And, you know, they kind of tolerate it. But I think what a lot of people are unaware of is just how political and how socialist the leadership of the NCAE and their parent group is. And I would urge them, if they want to go more in depth on this, I've written two pieces that have been published in the last week just on this whole issue and how politicized it's become. NCAE changed its leadership earlier this year, and they elected two people, Tamika Walker Kelly and Brian Proffitt, who were both active in the racial and social justice caucus arm of NCAE. And if anyone, you know, wants to know what exactly that's all about, it's socialism unbridled, basically. It's very politically driven. They have goals that are not educational. It's hard to find where the educational goals are in any of this. Just go to the website, go and see what kind of links they have on their website, et cetera. Their political goals. You know, they're very tied into Black Lives Matter, tied into the NEA and their other political goals, which are, you know, basically social policy goals that they want to bring into the classroom, Medicaid expansion, sensitivity to, you know, different gender and sexual norms, et cetera. That whole thing that I've gone into. And you can see more of that in some of the resolutions that were passed. I think, let me just give you an example of this. NEA is, and let me set it up a little so people have a better understanding of this. NEA is NCAE's parent organization. In other words, all the teacher organizations in different states are essentially affiliates or branches of the National Education Association, which is the largest teachers union in the country. NCAE is a branch of NEA. NEA is a teachers union. Now, people say here, well, you know, NCAE is not a union. In North Carolina, teachers can't collectively bargain. That's true. That is true. But you can also say, and this would be factual, that when someone joins NCAE, it's in their constitution, it's in the statement, the documents that you have to sign when you become a member, you are also a member of NEA. So you are a union member, essentially, in a state that prohibits union activity. So it's a distinction, but it's a distinction worth making, because these people are union members, and they're very heavily involved in union activity. Now, once a year, they have a convention where, like other large bodies, they pass resolutions which are indicative of member support, member opposition. Usually once a year, I'll write on some of the resolutions that get passed. And, you know, I do a little article on it, and it usually raises a lot of eyebrows because it's pretty left wing. So let me just give you a few of the resolutions or some of the topics of the resolutions that they passed last year. And it'll give you a flavor of kind of like where, you know, all this is headed, because NEA drives the bus on this, and NCAE, you know, comes along because they have to. So these are some of the topics that they approved as far as resolution: teaching white fragility, promoting Black Lives Matter, and mandating ethnic studies classes, ending zero tolerance policies, replacing restorative justice practices. They approved resolutions on teaching climate change, providing online and union-friendly resources in classrooms, and decriminalization of illegal border crossings, lobbying for LGBTQ curricula, lobbying for the Equality Act and other protections based on sexual orientation and gender identity, reaffirming the fundamental right to abortion, and opposing all attacks on the right to choose, ending white supremacy and English-only culture, teaching about linguistic oppression to children and how it stifles their academic achievement. So you get a sense of what's going on here. They hate the culture. They're out to destroy America as far as the way it's been defined, the way we live, and they're out to change things dramatically.
Bob, that's a let's camp on that for a minute before we're running out of time here. But you said that they're out to change America, the way that we know it, at least. So I know that some people, you'll watch some talking heads and on both sides, and they'll make those sort of accusations against the other side. But what is it about those, that list of things that you just read, that you really believe would fundamentally change the way in which younger people interact and understand our history? We talked about the importance of history at the very beginning of this show. So what should parents be looking out for, and what's so concerning about this?
Well, I think it's already here. If you go on to the Wake County schools, I mean, they have a website. They have websites there within the Wake County public school system. You look at, I mean, just look at some of the history curriculum. Look at some of the things that are being taught. I'm very aware of the problems of the racial problems in this country. I don't believe Black Lives Matter has raised legitimate issues, but I think people are unaware of a lot of the roots of that organization and what the organization teaches. There's a lot of people that are very sensitive to or empathetic towards their mission and have embraced what they want to do within the school system. And how you find that out, I mean, go on the websites, go on Facebook, go on teacher websites, etc. That's been embraced as, you know, as part of how we teach, you know, social studies, how we teach history, etc. That's disturbing because, I mean, if you look at, and I know we've had conversations of this, but their remedy to much of this is to overthrow the whole system. I mean, the leadership is are avowed Marxists, and that doesn't solve the racial problem. Okay. So, that's one of the issues. But does that help?
Yes, definitely it does. And I think that really it serves to showcase and highlight exactly where we're at right now. And that this isn't just ideas. Ideas actually have consequences. And so the teaching of those ideas and the acceptance or the attempt to normalize them is something that we need to be on alert for. But I know we've got to wrap it up. So Ray, you want to field this last question?
Yeah, I got a just kind of a practical question for parents that might be listening. I've got a two and 3 year old. What practical advice, Bob, can you give to somebody who may be just looking for a school for the first time? I mean, in my area, the public school's well rated, but I don't know much about it. So what advice can you give to parents who might be searching out a school for the first time, or just an education model, not necessarily a school within itself, but people who are looking for, you know, options? What advice can you give to parents out there?
That's a tough question right now, because we're in such a weird
time. Try to imagine that some of the COVID stuff is over and maybe, you know, hopefully we're back to normal.
Well, I think a lot of times good advice, you can talk to the normal people that you'd normally talk to, people, you know, administrators, teachers at the school, other students and so forth. But I think a lot of times people forget to talk to other parents. People that have, if you're checking a place out, I would go in there and, you know, go to the school, ask if you can visit, et cetera. And, you know, it doesn't take a lot to be you know, just be open about talking to other parents, you know, have kids in the school. Oftentimes, you know, the best advice comes from people that, you know, have no essential interest in, you know, telling you one way or the other. Unfortunately, you know, leaders of schools and, you know, administrators and so forth, you know, they want you there, et cetera, and there's nothing wrong with that. But oftentimes I think you get the best and the most honest advice from, you know, people who are seemingly more unbiased about it. So I would try to contact, if you're looking at a place, find out other parents who have kids in the school, you know, ask them what, you know, what they think, you know, about teachers, about the curriculum, about, you know, the things that they haven't thought about as far as logistics and so forth. I usually have found out that that's, you know, pretty helpful. Even, you know, and I remember doing that before I graduate school and just visiting a couple places and talked, you know, to students, not parents, but people that actually, you know, were in a position to give unbiased advice. And I found that very helpful. So if you can, you know, get in a situation where meet a few parents, if you're exploring, you know, a open house night or something, just go a little bit out of your way, meet a few parents, and get an unbiased view of, you know, of a school. I'm sure most people want to be helpful, and if they don't like it, they'll tell you. And if they do like it, they'll tell you. So, and I think that's helpful either way.
Yeah, that's obviously good advice. I'm excited about some of this creative destruction that's going to happen in education, not just higher education, but K-12 across the country and hopefully as well here in North Carolina. And that there'll be some positive outcomes for students. It's not just about maintaining a bureaucracy or not just about maintaining a system that doesn't work for everybody. That's Bob Lupke. Was Brooke joining us today too? Really appreciate your time. And we will have a podcast again next week. Check out all our content at nccivitas.org. Thank you.